Meeting will come to order, and it's the Civil Justice Policy Committee and the Energy Finance and Policy Division. And with that, I'll turn the gavel over to Chair Hilty, because the majority of the policy is in his division.
Chair Mallory, this is an informational hearing only today. We're not going to be voting on anything. The hearing will be dedicated to one bill. It's House File 1182, Representative Bly's bill, which would repeal certain exemptions that are accorded currently to the public service corporation. And with that, I would just call upon our first testifier on the agenda. Representative Bly, did you want to make any opening remarks?
Yes, I will. First of all, Chair Hilty and members, Chair Mallory as well, I thank you for arranging for this hearing and taking the time to fully talk about this particular issue. In 2008, some constituents brought this concern, this issue that that they were facing with the Mincan pipeline coming across their property, and they had many concerns and brought my attention to this this issue. And it's my intent that and my hope that we can have an airing of this policy, which is a result of the 2005 Kelo decision of the U.S. Supreme Court, which promulgated the 2006 legislature to put in place new procedures for dealing with eminent domain. And they did exempt some of the public service utilities from some of those procedures and rules. And I believe it's time, having heard the comments from my constituents, that it's time to at least have a conversation about are those working and what needs to be done about them. So without further ado, I would turn it over to testifiers who come to talk about this issue and how it's affected them.
Representative Hilty? Chair Hilty?
Representative Halpert.
Thank you. If I might, Representative Bly, we have a number of documents here in front of us, and I'm wondering, are we speaking to any particular one? I have a copy and a research brief of the original bill, and then a document that has a time stamp yesterday afternoon, and then another piece of paper here that just has changes to 117.189. So I'm just curious, if are we working off a particular document or proposal? Or
well,
Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair Hilty. And with them, Holford, those documents kind of show some of the history of this particular bill, to try to make sure that you're up to speed about what attempts we made in the past to deal with this issue. The one that's dated most recently was I think to try to reflect some of the changes that did go into effect. Is that correct, Mr. Elam?
Yes, there were changes made in that section of the bill as a result of during conference committee on the energy omnibus bill last year that made some changes in the section of the law that your bill also was going to change.
So it's just to bring you up to speed about what kind of where we have been. My hope is that we will have a discussion. And if I introduce, change my bill or amend my bill, it may look differently than it does right here. But I'm also hoping that from this discussion, I'll learn more about how to shape that in the best way.
Representative Holford.
If I might, could somebody let me know what passed the House floor already and then what happened in conference committee? Did we make any changes enacted into law, or did everything get lost in conference committee?
There was, Chair Hilton and Holbrook, it's a little bit complicated. There was in the Energy Committee an amendment to the assessment reimbursement in the Energy Committee, and that went forward. There was a floor amendment which attempted to remove the exemptions for utilities, and that did pass the floor. And in Conference Committee, that was not agreed to, but there, the assessment reimbursement was increased even more, I think doubled what it had been from our. So those were the changes that were made.
All right, thank you.
Representative Mahler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bly, I made a commitment on the floor, and I want to make sure that I'm meeting it. Now, with my understanding, we were having this hearing on both your bill from last year plus the amendment that you put on the floor of the House, but I'm told that by staff that you wanted to change the hearing to discussing this, where, and you're certainly not bound by that to the future, but I just want to make sure that in your mind we're meeting the commitment that
I believe you are, and okay. And let me be clear that Chair Hilty and Chair Mullery, my sense is that we're talking about the issue of whether or not it's time to change some of these exemptions to eminent domain, regardless of my bill. I mean, my bill, I think, is the impetus for talking about it. But I agree with you that what you agreed to is what I'm believing that we will be talking about.
Fine. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Chairman, if you could help me out here. Whose document is BE070? Is this a bill that's going to be introduced? Was this an amendment that was introduced on the House floor and adopted by the House? Is this somebody's wishful thinking, or is this current law? If you could just clarify that for me.
Well, actually, I believe Representative Bly is the person that can clarify that for you. This is not a bill that has passed any body of the legislature, but Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair Hilty and Representative Diskin. As Bob Eloff explained, this is for your information to reflect what the changes to the law were. It may not be the, you know, what we asked for in the end, or what we proposed or amend our bill to look like, but just for your information to know what was agreed to and passed reflects the changes of the assessment reimbursement, and that is in here. Now, going forward, this might see how it looks, but I am hoping, as I said, take guidance from this testimony today and the conversation, continue the conversation as we head into session, to decide upon what shape the actual bill that I present later will be like.
Thank you, Chair Hill.
To clarify, go ahead. The bill as it was introduced repealed the exemptions for public service corporations.
Correct.
I think Representative Bly is still interested in having that go forward. That's what we're here to talk about, but that's not current law.
Well, Mr. Chair, but Representative Bly just stated that the BE070 reflects the changes in law. Is that the wishful changes in law, or is that the changes in law, Representative?
Chair Hilty and Representative, I'm sorry to be confusing, but if you, the sentence that reads "for purposes of an award of appraisal fees and so on," that reflects changes that were made, and it's not underlined, so that's in law. The underlying portions that would be a change, those would be proposed, you know, that was in the original bill to propose those changes. So, no, it's not in law. It's what currently the bill that I introduced showed we wanted to accomplish. Now, as to whether or not it is what the final shape of my bill will look like, I haven't decided yet. And I have scheduled meetings with some people who want to talk with me about that bill, both landowners and stakeholders. So, my interest is in having a full hearing, and I'm very appreciative to the two chairs who've agreed to do this, and hopefully we'll learn a great deal from the discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't mean to drag this out, but Representative Bly, the original bill that I signed on to as co-author was a very simple striking of one sentence. So I'm not sure that the BE070 matches the original bill, because originally we, you and I, agreed that public service corporations of any kind shouldn't have less standard when taking other people's properties than local units of government. But now I see that there's some major changes in this. And is that where you're going to go in the next session?
Not necessarily, no. I mean, I want to discuss that with you and with others about what direction we ought to go in. So this isn't necessarily a signal of the direction it's going to go in, but it captures, I think, where we were when we stopped.
So no white flags yet.
That's right.
Excellent.
With all of that clarification, Mr. Peterson, representing the Farmers Union, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Hilty and Chair Mullery. My name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union, and I'm actually speaking in favor of the House File 1182. So that's something that we've supported Farmers Union for quite a while, the idea. Since we made the changes in 2006 to eminent domain, Farmers Union, other farm groups were very involved in that legislation after the Kelo decision. But I remember standing on the front steps of the Capitol, some of you were there, when we signed that legislation. There was a really good story in the Star Tribune that day about some of the issues with public service corporations. And it was kind of an empty feeling on some of that, because I think that representing farm groups, be really clear that pipelines and transmission lines are the really big things that go across properties, and those are big issues that we have. And we're definitely seeing it within our own organization. The way we work is we're organized in 77 counties. We have locals in all those counties. We have meetings, pass resolutions, and then have support. We're seeing that again this year, where we have very good turnouts in some of those areas where people are discussing pipelines and transmission lines. And they want to talk about this issue. They want to be treated fairly, not against transmission lines. We haven't taken a position against the CapEx or different pipelines. Just want to be paid fairly, want to be treated fairly. We had some farmers that I hope that would be able to come up here with me today, but they have other issues with their soybean and corn that are very serious that they're working on. And so I do urge you to take a good consideration of this legislation. I appreciated the appraisal fees. That was a big issue for a lot of farmers, that getting the appraisal done on $500 was difficult. But there are other things that they bring up. You know, I do mention the attorney fees, the loss of public going concern. Compensation is always the bottom line on how landowners are compensated for their property. And I guess making the case also that, farmland is, we don't make new farmland, and landowners are very strong about the protections, and it's hard a lot of times to go up against an entity. I think I heard it last year where they'll say, well, we only had one or two go to eminent domain, we didn't have a lot. But it's tough when you're a landowner and you're facing attorney fees, you have to hire attorney fees, you have to get the appraisals. You're going up against a company, corporation, public service corporation that has those resources. It's tough for a single landowner. And I hope that you consider the protections that you're giving those landowners when we're looking at this legislation. And so I'll just close with that and just urge your consideration for looking at this next session. We're open to looking at those issues and seeing what we can do and if there's certain areas that need to be worked on or whatnot. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Peterson, Representative Diskin. Representative
Dunker. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Peterson, several years ago when we came up with CapEx 2020, we talked about farmers having power lines go through their property. I think it's, as I remember, 3.7 acres per mile or section. And generally speaking, the power company goes and pays somewhere near market value in some formula. And there's not... the eminent domain is usually not exercised. However, the complaints the farmers in my county had were, once the guy that originally signed the contract with the power company got his money, and spent it. Then he sold his land, and the next guy didn't get anything. And he says, why don't we make it fair? Why don't we sit there and say, okay, this is the value of the land. Let's have a monthly or annual payment that goes on forever. We can't give them both because the people that buy electricity have to pay that bill ultimately. But that is something that, the people in my area wanted. What do you think of that way of doing it?
Mr. Peterson. Mr. Chairman and Representative Gunter, that is actually our policy, Farmers Union. We, you know, that's something that farmers are very supportive of. Actually pursued it in the Senate actually a couple of years ago in one of the committees. You know, farmers are very interested in that, trying to find some kind of formula or looking at an ongoing, you know, because you're going over the land. You get a one-time payment, you got to farm around it, you got to, you know, deal with having this the road in there maybe, and you got to have the tower in there or whatever you're going to have in there on an ongoing basis. And so there is a lot of support for that in the countryside too. And you know, I wanted to mention one other thing too that I think is important. That I think some of these things are improving with the CapEx. One of the things, I think they've done a good job of having quite a few meetings and having a lot of the information out in the public. Things are getting better. I served as chairman of the State Organic Task Force for the last 4 years that advised Commissioner Hugeson. One of the things we worked on was working with the pipeline companies on organic farms and mitigating some of the losses on that. And they've been very good about, you know, coming up with some of those. But that gets at, you know, the day-to-day things. You're an organic farm and you have other issues with the ongoing issues with the pipeline, and or if you're having to farm around that. So there is support for that.
Any questions for Mr. Peterson? Seeing none, thank you. Russell Martin? Martin, welcome.
Good morning. I'd like to start by thanking you. I have to read this because I get off track.
Before you begin, Mr. Martin, would you please identify yourself to the record?
Okay, my name is Russell Martin. My wife and I built a single-family home in 1972 on 2.5 acres located southwest of the Elko New Market area on a dead-end road. Our children now live out of state, so when I retired 4.5 years ago, we started planning to relocate. That all changed in mid-May of 06. The land agent came to our home requesting that I sign an easement allowing a crude oil pipeline. It had been relocated and was now in our front yard. I told the agent I would not sign an easement without a dollar value. There was no monetary number on that initial paper. And I requested information on how that dollar value would be determined. He returned in September, 4 months later, with a value but no information on how it was determined. The agent informed me that he was sorry that we would lose most of the trees in our front yard and that that was where the pipeline would be. He also let me know that the company offer included a bonus or premium for early signing. The agent then stated the company could use eminent domain, but that I would lose the bonus. I felt I was being pressured to accept something that was not fair or just. The new eminent domain law had been reported in the news as greatly improving landowner property rights during a taking. I looked on the internet to find the statute, and I'm not an attorney, but I felt the statute had notice, appraisal, and a fee structure award that would encourage reasonable offers leading to reasonable settlements, until I read exemption 117-189. I had to read it several times before I accepted the fact that the public service corporations are exempt from provisions that would encourage these corporations to do appraisals and disclose information to support their offers. In my case, the talk stopped after that September, thereby moving us into the legal/court process. A side note here. A refusal of an offer does not stop or even slow down the progress of these projects. It really has no bearing on that. The next step is that the corporation files a quick take at the local courthouse and receives legal title to the property. A part of the quick take process requires a deposit at the courthouse reflective of what the corporation has determined the taking is worth. In my case, the amount was reduced by 25%. I have heard from others that their deposit has increased over their last offer. And that kind of goes to the fact that there was not a lot of research done prior to these offers being made. What I have learned is that there is no incentive for the Public Service Corporation to treat the property owner fairly or equitably. There is no way to recover the expenses incurred by property owners to defend the value of their assets. These include appraisals for a before and after taking, damages to the properties, which include landscaping, trees, etc., and the attorney fees. These exemptions encourage the Public Service Corporation to make a low-ball offer. If the property owner accepts the offer, the Public Service Corporation has reduced its cost. If the owner does not accept their offer, the Public Service Corporation will do a quick take, thereby forcing the owner to do the appraisals necessary to present at a commission hearing. This will take at least a year, probably longer, to resolve. At a commission hearing, the commissioners are not allowed to consider any fees in their award because of these exemptions. The property owner is left paying an appraisal and attorney fees to defend his property value. But the result is that he loses a minimum of 30% of whatever that award might be. On top of that, he may be exposed to untimely capital gains. Now, the state of Kentucky allows exemptions from capital gains involving property taken on eminent domain. Now, I, along with many others, have been coming here for over 3 years, meeting with senators and legislators, trying to point out the shortcomings of these exemptions. Many of you have listened, but many of you have refused to hear how these exemptions have made it impossible for property owners to receive fair and or just compensation. You have authorized these public service corporations to use eminent domain. That is a power that can't be equaled anywhere. You need to implement the tools necessary to allow the property owner to receive fair and just compensation. And I think the first step would be to repeal those exemptions. That's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Are there questions for this witness? Seeing none, thank you. Bell Scott.
Can you hear me okay? Okay. Thank you for letting me address you today. I'm grateful for this opportunity to testify on House File 1182 and to be a small part of the testimony that confirms the need for the removal of exceptions to the eminent domain law.
Stop before you proceed. Would you please identify yourself?
Yes. My name is Bev Topp, and I'm from Lakeville, Minnesota. I'm the founder and chair of the Citizens Energy Task Force. But I'm here today speaking as a citizen. Removing the exemptions to the eminent domain law is a pressing issue that will have a serious impact on the landowners in Minnesota who will have to host the numerous high-voltage transmission lines that are proposed. It will probably affect the constituents of most or all of the legislators in attendance today. The eminent domain law changes that were passed in 2006 went a long way to protect citizens and give them a fair deal for their land in eminent domain cases. However, as you know, public service corporations were exempted from these laws by Statute 117.189. All electric utilities, including the 11 entities that comprise CapEx 2020, are PSCs and receive this benefit. Although a couple of the exemptions in this law have been modified in the last two legislative sessions, the bulk of the exemptions still apply to PSCs, including utilities, in the taking of landowner property for transmission lines. Exemptions like Minnesota Statute 117.031 still apply. While landowners are protected from unjust low offers from the government in condemnation proceedings, they have no such protection from utility offers. Regardless of the percentage of difference between a utility's initial offer and the final awarded judgment, they will not be reimbursed for attorney's fees, even when the difference is 40% or more. Statute 117.186 provides compensation for loss of a going concern's value if a business is destroyed in the eminent domain process, and up to 3 years of gross income for damages to a business if 51% of driveway access is lost or taken. Utilities are exempted from this provision. It also exempts them from providing minimum compensation sufficient for the owner to purchase a comparable property in the community. There are more exemptions that I will not go into for the sake of time, but I would like to point out that when bad offers are made with no landowner protections for the eminent domain process, the road to a fair and just resolution for them is long and arduous and expensive, with no recovery of costs under the present exemptions to the 2006 eminent domain laws. I've talked to a couple of citizens who are still going through this nightmare on the Runcan pipeline project for the South Metro area, and each step of the way for them costs more and more money for appraisals and attorney fees with no hope for recovery. This is just not fair. I've heard it said that the electric companies will treat landowners fairly, regardless of the Minnesota laws on eminent domain, but I'd like to point out a 2007 article in the Farmington Independent that raises strong questions about that assertion, and I will give you that article when I'm done here. The article reports on a group of Farmington citizens battling with Great River Energy for more than a year, trying to get adequate compensation for land taken to construct a 115 kilovolt power line across portions of their property. Mediation finally awarded these landowners $55,000, a 376% increase over the original $14,600 offer. But because of the utility exemptions to Minnesota eminent domain laws, even if these landowners win GRE's appeal to the mediation decision, much of the increase they realize goes to attorney fees. Many Farmington landowners accepted the $14,600 offer. Was it because they thought it was fair and that they should give away their easements for the public good? I would suggest it was out of a historical lack of faith in the system to give them fair treatment under the old laws, and an unwillingness to confront the powerful utilities whose pockets are deep and only gain by extending time for payment. Does the much higher offer to those who appealed and went through the complicated system of receiving justice suggest they got overpayments from a biased court or mediation process? I doubt that. I constantly hear the argument that low tax ratepayer costs must be considered as large high-voltage transmission lines are built. Indeed, this argument is grounded every conversation around the justification to build new dirty coal plants and to continue the use of old dirty coal plants. In the case of CapEx 2020, for example, Big Stone 2 was a large factor in justifying their construction being listed in key engineering studies as a source of energy for those lines. In fact, with Big Stone 2's demise, there are many more questions around need for these lines. But to get back to the ratepayer-landowner argument on unfair exceptions to the eminent domain law, I'd like to point out that if you ask your constituents whether or not they would like a tiny reduction on their kilowatt hour costs acquired on the backs of unfairly low offers to landowners who are forced to host these lines, my bet is that they, like me, would say no. They might even point out that they could be the next affected landowner and that they would like fair treatment in negotiating condemnation. Groups opposed to high-voltage large transmission lines are working very hard to ensure that these lines do not take advantage of Minnesota ratepayers and property owners while bringing little benefit to our state and much potential to slow down the development of local, economically beneficial renewable energy. Why is it then that we would ask our landowners to not only host these questionable lines, to endure a viewscape of 170-foot high towers every 600 to 900 feet, with a constant hum and an admitted safety issue of dangerous EMFs that the World Health Organization in studies has been determined to raise the incidence of leukemia in children, and then we want to ask them to give away their property value too? In the upcoming legislative session, you have an opportunity to right an egregious wrong and create a level playing field for landowners who are asked to turn over their properties for the alleged greater good of the people of Minnesota. Please do not fail them by leaving the present exemptions for public service corporations in place. Remove these exemptions. In the future, many more of your constituents will become these affected landowners and will be expecting justice when asked to sacrifice for a perceived greater good. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Topp, you cited 186. I'm just trying to look at it real quick, and I can't understand it that quick. But it's loss of going concern. Does that normally apply to, and I can't remember from being involved in these cases, whether, does that normally apply to easements like this or not? I didn't.
Yeah. As far as I know, there may be someone here who disputes that, but as far as I understand, and you'll be having an attorney speak to you later. And
I think we have attorneys later on it.
Okay.
We can ask them. Thanks.
Further questions, Chairman Topp? No, thank you.
Thank you. Can I just give these to someone on the end and have them pass it around? It's the article from the Farmington Independent. Thank you.
It's already in the packet.
We might have it.
I understand it's already in the packet.
Okay, it's in the packet. Wonderful. Thank you.
Next on our list, we have Steve Coleman.
Chairman Hilton. Chairman Hilton, thank you. My name is Steve Coleman. I'm a landowner affected, and I'm also the chief executive officer of RES Specialty Pyrotechnics, which is a small business I have located on my home property. As I stated, my name is Steve Coleman. I'm a landowner in Darien Township in Latour County, just west of New Prague. If any of you know where Union Hill is, I'm approximately a mile and a half from there. My wife and I built our home on this property approximately 11 years ago. I'm also a small business owner. My business is also located on this property. My company, RES Specialty Pyrotechnics, is a manufacturer of theatrical pyrotechnics. These close proximity fireworks are used in music concerts, theme parks, and special events worldwide. Tours by Paul McCartney and Kiss, the Minnesota Vikings and Gopher football, a theme park with very large mouse ears, as well as the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, this November 9th, where our former president will be in attendance. Our product is being used on Brandenburg Gate as part of that celebration. I'm very proud of that. Products from China and the U.S. regulatory environment have virtually eliminated pyrotechnics manufacturing in the United States. We, however, have managed to find a niche market and run a profitable business in Minnesota that employs people. I have 10 full-time employees, I have 3 part-time employees, and over the summer season when we provide displays for our various communities, I employ approximately 60 to 70 part-time people that help with our business also. Finding a suitable location for a business such as ours is no easy task. When looking to find an appropriate location for my business, it took me almost a year. And actually, looking back, it was actually a little longer than a year. Regulations require us to be in a rural, open location with large separation distances between us and our neighbors. During these past 11 years, we've enjoyed an excellent relationship with my neighbors, as well as Latour County, fire police, and regulatory officials. The CapEx 2020 proposed power line has 2 routes, preferred and alternate. Both of these routes, however, cross in one small common area. Unfortunately for me, my property is located in this And if you take a look at the attachments that I've included with the map, it shows an overall map and then a zoomed-in area of where our business is located. If you look at the zoomed-in one, you'll see basically the power line is proposed along that red route in that area. That blue line is essentially the edge of my property line. I have a very large, rather a narrow, long piece of property that's approximately 650 foot wide by about 2,300 foot long.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Holberg.
Mr. Corman, we don't have a color map. Could you just kind of hold up and maybe point out
so we can... to give you an idea, I'll hold this up for you. I do have color copies with me if you prefer me to hand those out.
Mr. Chair, I think if he can just kind of point out for us, that would be enough.
This red line here, which kind of shows in the map their border, and you'll see a series of small dots here that represent buildings. The dot at the very top here, which is on my map, pink, obviously it's showing your color, that is my home. Around the side there, they have marked not all, but some of my buildings and my explosives. So it's put down front. But just give you a rough idea.
Thank you.
My home is approximately 125 foot inside the property line. The barn, which is next to my house, is only 50 foot from the property line. From what my understanding is, the proposed line would take a minimum of 75 foot of my property, putting my barn in their right-of-way, and a 345 kilovolt power line directly over my home. According to my attorney, it's common for a utility to increase the right-of-way to double the amount for the construction phase of the project. This would essentially put them in my home. From a homeowner and property owner perspective, the effects would be devastating, making my home unsellable, not to mention potentially unlivable due to safety concerns of these lines directly over my home. From a business perspective, the situation is equally disturbing. At minimum, I would need to remove one of my explosives magazine as it would be in the right-of-way directly under the power line. Because of the distance and separation requirements, there are no suitable areas to relocate this magazine on my property. Electricity, especially static and stray voltage, is a particular concern in our business. Our building floors and tabletops are specially constructed and coated to keep these hazards to an acceptable level. Conductive footwear is needed as well as other protective, personal protective gear. The product we manufacture is designed to be fired electric and requires protective measures to be taken. It does not take a rocket scientist to understand that explosives and high power voltage lines are not compatible. It is interesting to note, however, that NASA recommends power lines be located no closer to explosives than the length of the lines between the support towers. From my understanding, in this case, this would be approximately 1,000 feet from the power line in question. How can I possibly guarantee my employees' safety will not be compromised by these power lines in close proximity to my business? Quite simply, I can't. Other regulatory concerns and the burden that would be created along with that I have mentioned would likely end my business. The loss of employment, loss of income, and the enormous cost of trying to relocate and start over would likely be impossible. The current exception to the eminent domain laws afforded the Great River Energy and CapEx 2020 projects makes no sense to the people of Minnesota. This law, to my understanding, was designed to protect landowners from past abuses inflicted by MnDOT and cities on private landowners. Why should a public service utility not be held to the same standard? Without this protection, my employees, family, my fellow neighbors, and I stand to lose everything with no legal recourse. I'm not particularly against pipelines, electricity lines going through, but there is no recourse I have, and especially as is mentioned by the former speaker, of going continuing business. For me to try to find something and try to set up at my own expense would likely not be a possibility. So I strongly urge you to reconsider the repeal of this and what Representative Bly is suggesting. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Coleman. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Coleman. Has there been an issue of whether or not that would be a taking of your property? Has your attorney told you it
wouldn't
apply?
I'm sorry. What I'm understanding right now is, in essence, where the line would run essentially right down the length of my property, I would probably end up having a power station, substation, either directly north or south of my location. I would be looking at losing approximately a minimum of 75 foot along that eastern property edge of my as part of the right of way, which would, you know, obviously they'd probably be looking at clear cutting that area. One of my magazines, obviously, is there. You know, it's going to be, that's from my understanding, and when the representative from Great River Energy came out to look at my property after we made them aware of the situation and confirmed that that's where they were going to run the, you know, the transmission line, essentially along that property line. That's where I have my calculations from for this.
We'll take it up later. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We can ask the attorneys later on that question.
Further questions from the phone? Okay, no, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Ahern.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the both committees. My name is Mike Ahern. I'm an attorney, and my role here today is just to kind of confirm and explain the history of the Public Service Commission exemption as it appears. As it's already been alluded to, the 2006 amendments to the eminent domain statute were precipitated by concerns, Supreme Court decision, and other issues and anecdotal evidence that there were serious problems with the private taking of one business or home for resale or reuse for another private business. And this was primarily by local units of government, economic development type agencies. And that was the overriding concern of the 2006 legislative changes. As a representative of gas, electric, telephone, and pipeline companies, I testified at that time that the types of concerns that were raised in the principal concern of the 2006 legislation really didn't deal with utility takings. The utility type takings, contrary to I'd say the prior speakers, where you affect a complete business, is relatively rare. Utility takings are usually an easement, the right to use property beneath or above the property, but most of the ongoing use of the property for most uses can be continued. And then there's obviously a compensation element there. I testified at that time repeatedly in 2006 that there were distinctions and that if the committee had time to deal with them, we were prepared to discuss them. But at the time, I think the legislature understood and that there were they wanted to take care of the squeaky wheel, and at that time it was the governmental unit takings. And as a result, both the authors and the legislature said, we'll move this aside, and as a result, the new changes that were imposed to deal with the issues raised by those kinds of takings were put into law, and those new provisions simply, public service corporations were exempted. And that's the long and the short of how it got there. At that time, I know I said that at some point in the future, the legislature may want to look at, as we are right now, those exemptions in the process. But there are major distinctions between the situations dealt with in 2006 versus what we have with public utility uses of their easement. We have certificate of need proceedings, siting and routing processes, an extensive amount of public involvement in virtually every use by a public service corporation. Those were all things that were lacking at the time. Similarly, there are very special provisions that over the years have been added to and do not apply to other uses, such as many of you may be aware that for electric transmission purchases, a public service corporation can be required to buy a complete farm and not just acquire an easement, the so-called buy the farm provision. So there are distinctions, and it sounds like and looks like the legislature this year is going to give thoughtful consideration to public utility and public service corporation uses of eminent domain, and we welcome that discussion. And I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Given the testimony by Mr. Corman, from your perspective, if in fact it is necessary to destroy some of his buildings related to his business, etc., from your perspective and expertise, what rights for compensation does he have under current law?
Mr. Chairman, I believe, as a practical matter, as I mentioned, that type of a situation is relatively rare, but it can happen, and I do believe that in most condemnation proceedings, that could be recognized as a taking of a going concern, and thus be entitled to the type of compensation, even without the statute. I am not a condemnation lawyer. I have represented and worked in this issue for years at the Capitol, but there may be even common law on that type of a situation. But I do know that I think in the routine pipeline transmission line situation, that doesn't come up that often.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This isn't necessarily a question for Mr. Ahern, but maybe for some of the other testifiers that are coming up that I see on the list here. When we did, just a comment first, when we did this eminent domain amendments in 2006, about the same time, and I think Representative Holberg was still chairing Transportation Committee at that time, we had some hearings in Rochester because of a hue and a cry of the way MnDOT appraisers or people hired by MnDOT were treating landowners around the Route 52 project. If I recall, we had some of these same principal discussions about why we didn't want to apply eminent domain reform to MnDOT, because they're kind of like a public service corporation that they buy and build highways and so on. However, I think we did actually amend the way they could handle appraisers, pay for, or the way the appraisals had to be traded and so on and so forth. Some of the discussion was around that involved unintended consequences, bad things might happen, the cost could go outside, so on and so forth. So I guess what I'm asking is, if anybody can speak to that, how the experience has been the last 3 years since we've actually made those changes, did the wheels fall off, the wings fall off, are things working, are we making it work, how did it drive costs? Those would, I think, be relevant things for us to know as we talk about possible changes to public service corporations.
Mr. Ahern, do you have a... Mr. Chairman, since I followed that, I've offered the thought that the MnDOT-specific changes were enacted in the statute. Mm-hmm. However, as is the case, for example, with the buy-the-farm provision, frequently industry or situational-specific changes are put elsewhere in the statute. Thus, the additional due process notice and other provisions applicable to MnDOT takings are contained in the MnDOT statute rather than the Chapter 117. And I think that you may have a speaker on the agenda from the League of Cities who might be able to even speak to current experience with the 2006 amendment.
Representative
Bly, Chair Hilty, I did, and Representative Beard, have a conversation with Representative Junkie, who is an appraiser and also deals with some of the MnDOT issues. And he, according to his opinion, things were working very well, that it wasn't this, that he thought it was a good procedure, a good system that worked well.
Mr. Chair, I'm sure that we'll have, after we're in session officially, I'll probably have this, if this bill comes forward, more hearings. And I think maybe some of us could make sure we had a MnDOT person or two or somebody to speak to that that could shed some light on how it's worked. That could be very helpful to us. Thanks.
Further questions for Mr. Ingram? Seeing none, thank you. Mr. Sundberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Lee Sundberg with the Minnesota Rural Electric Association. The electric co-ops and all the utilities recognize that when we acquire easements to put power lines over the property of landowners, that the landowners lose some rights to their land, and we certainly understand that this creates concerns with those who are in the path of the power line, and many people would, of course, prefer that we go anywhere else, and, of course, that's why the we have those popular acronyms of NIMBY and BANANA and all that. But we also do have the obligation to serve, and in the first sections of the Public Utilities Act, the legislature finds that it is in the public interest to that the utilities provide safe, reliable, adequate, efficient service. And the legislature has also found that utilities provide 25% of its power to renewable resources. But if we are to fulfill those obligations to the state and to our customers, the legislature has also finds that utilities need to construct facilities to provide such services, thereby recognizing that the placement of transmission is a necessary burden on landowners. Speaking for the electric co-op, we learned valuable lessons 30 years ago, as many of you might recollect, on how not to do it. And we've worked hard since then to make sure that the process is fair and respectful to the landowner. And that exception aside, I think it's very fair to say that utilities have a history of being responsible and working with the landowners in the acquisitions of right-of-way, and that our offers have been fair is evidenced by the fact that as Mr. Aarons pointed out, that there have been very, very few, a small percentage of the right-of-way for a typical transmission line is taken by eminent domain. That's the last resort. We do not want to use eminent domain. And based on the percentages that we've seen that we've used it so far, I think that bears that out. The vast majority of the cases are worked out between the utility and the landowner without the need for condemnation proceedings, legal, the hiring of lawyers, and other costly measures. And in a typical situation, the landowner retains the right to use the land under the power line, and like on agricultural land, the utility pays the farm person for the loss of crops during construction, projected future losses, and in same with timber as well. If timber is removed to make room for line, compensation to pay for that timber as well. All utilities believe that we have worked fairly and openly with landowners as we construct our facilities to meet our obligations. Reasonable rates, as was mentioned, is obviously a concern to us. It is an obligation that we must follow. You've given us that obligation to try to keep prices as low as possible for our customers. We understand that it's never popular to acquire transmission easements, even when it is being taken for a clear public good, for reliability, for renewable energy access, and we believe that we've been responsible and fair to landowners, balanced with the state requirement of serving our customers. And we want to be reasonable and fair during the acquisition process. But at the same time, we do not want the process either to be used to delay progress and increase our costs. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So, Mr. Sundberg, does the REA have a position on Representative Bly's bill, then? Are you...
On House File 1182, we have opposed it. Yeah. We oppose repealing the exemption. We'll be glad to work with Representative Bly on trying to see what directions we might be able to go.
And Mr. Sundberg, you have any thoughts about what direction that might be?
We'll have to have further discussions, Mr. Chair. glad to discuss further.
And let me ask also, the question raised by Representative Gunther and addressed by Mr. Peterson earlier about possibility of different compensation arrangements, such as ongoing payments or easement rather than the upfront payment that doesn't carry forward. Have you given that any thought? Do you have a position about that?
Mr. Chairman, when this was being discussed, I think we even had a task force, or the legislature created a task force to look at that issue, and we did have our concerns about it. And looking at the potential cost increases that might lead to, I don't think there was ever a real settled position as that turned out. But I have kind of leaning towards that could be very an expensive way of proceeding.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sundberg, could you just let me know which one of these statutory requirements do you routinely violate that would cause you undue hardship if you had to adhere to?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Siskin, I don't think we violate any of the exemption provisions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Sundberg, then, is it your testimony that you routinely adhere to these sections, even though you're not required to, and so thereby requiring you to probably is no big deal?
Mr. Chair, Representative Biskin, as Mr. The previous testifier indicated, we have utilities proceed, have other processes that make it very difficult for us to not consider fairly through the Certificate of Need process, the siting process, before the Public Utilities Commission and potentially through appeals, the appeals court, that were very fair and reasonable in following through with our process. And that's why we don't often, very seldom need use the eminent domain process.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, the other side of that coin would be you never have to use it simply because these poor landowners don't have the funds to fight you, right? And I'm saying that very seriously. You know, the argument that we don't have to use eminent domain means everything is wonderful is a shallow argument, all right? So often you don't have to use eminent domain because the family and the landowners feel so bullied that they feel they have no other choice but to give in.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've watched this. I watched this back when it was being done in 2006. This isn't really a question, but you can speak to it. Essentially, what we're fighting about here is the fact that our landowners, when they go into court, have to pay their own legal fees, which puts them in a pretty poor position against the ratepayers, who are the ones who are paying for all this in the end. And I know that back in 2006, in a conversation I had with a couple of the people involved in the eminent domain argument, was that whether it was the transportation or power companies or economic development, that the judge gets three assessments, appraisals, doesn't share them with anyone. The taking entity, if their dollar figure wasn't within 5% of the average of those three, attorney fees were awarded to the landowner. It's very simple. Still, the risk was there. You decide to take your case forward. And the looks in the eyes of the people who were running that particular bill were pretty much told me that didn't have a whole lot of legs. But we've got pages and pages and pages of law where it really breaks down to who pays the attorney. That's the fight. And that's the simplest solution, is figuring out a way for the attorney fees to get paid, so that the landowners can go into court and get a fair hearing. But the other side to this particular coin is that, these arguments come up with our more rural members on a regular basis. But remember, it is the urban people who end up paying for it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sundberg, could you characterize what is the hesitation for support and changes in the laws among the utilities? What is the exact source of the opposition to Representative Bly's bill?
Mr. Sundberg?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative. We feel that the exemptions are duplicative, that we take these steps and go through many of the issue areas in the certificate of need and siting process before the Public Utilities Commission, which are appealable. We have to find this balance between what's fair for the landowner and fair for our rate-paying customers. Trying to keep that obligation to both in balance, and we're concerned that going one step in one direction may ricochet off and go too far in a different direction. And I know we're playing with or concerned and issued over how to balance that, those concerns on both sides, and as Representative Mulder just pretty well described.
Mr.
Chair and Mr. Sundberg, you raised the PUC. Do they have some? Do they say whether or not you can do certain things? I thought you were inferring that they have something to do with any of these exceptions, or can limit you in some way here or whatever. Is that true?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, no, I'm sorry if I left that impressed. The PUC does not, I believe, there's somebody from the PUC or one of the attorneys that practiced before the PUC, get into eminent domain issues unless it could be a service territory. Well, not even service territory, now that I think about it. But what I was trying to indicate is that before the PUC, what we're doing is we're required to go through a certificate of need process and the siting process. That was my point. The PUC does not get into eminent domain issues.
I just wanted to thank you, Chair Hilty. I just wanted to make one comment to Representative Mahoney. you know, oftentimes you do bring clarity to issues, and I appreciate what you said. However, I think just a reminder that although the urban ratepayers may be paying for it, they also receive the benefit of the power that's coming in, and the rural members, rural constituents, who don't necessarily receive that benefit. So there's that too.
If you want to, Mr. Chair, Representative Bly, if you would like to see the demographics of the rural members that work in the urban area, we can go through this. But I'll be kind here and just let it go and say that the chairs of both these committees understand my chagrin the way we finance energy in this state.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sundberg, just clarify for us that the eminent domain, the privilege of exercising eminent domain as a public service corporation cannot be exercised by any of your members just because they feel like doing it on a particular day, can they? Isn't it true that they have to have a certificate of need issued by the PUC process and the siting, the routing plan approved before the eminent domain comes into play? Correct me if I'm wrong on that, but I want us to be clear on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, that is correct. Can't go buy up or use eminent domain on anything we feel like it. That's right.
Just a technical question. At what level, what size of power line do you have to go to the PUC for a certificate of need for? I honestly don't know what the answer is.
Mr. Chair, I think, Representative Beard, we lowered that a couple of sessions ago to 115.
That's what I thought we did. I couldn't recall exactly. So you can't just go out and decide you're going to build a 115 kV line from here to there just because you feel like it would be beneficial to your company or your shareholders. You actually have to go to PUC and apply for that and go through that set of hearings.
Yes, I'm Mr. Chair, Representative Baird. There's a kilovolt requirement and a mile requirement as well. If it's like from a substation to a pole a half a block away or something, no, then the utility would not. But
well, again, perhaps a coming witness can clarify a little more if there's further light to be shed on that thing.
Further questions for Mr. Sundberg? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rick Evans. I'm with Xcel Energy. I apologize for not getting my name turned in early enough to get on your agenda, but it sounds maybe you've used up all your hard questions on Mr. Sundberg, and so I turned out to be shrewd instead of just incompetent. Let me add the voice of Xcel Energy, and we have talked with other utilities, so I think I speak broadly for the utilities as we look at this issue. We understand that it's critical that the processes by which transmission lines are routed and compensation is determined has to be fair, has to be honest, and has to be open to all the parties. The process of building transmission lines has a number of important steps that work to fulfill this goal. Some have already been talked about. First, as mentioned, we need to go to a public process with the Public Utilities Commission in order to even get permission to build the power line. That is a process that is open to any private party that wants to come in and talk about it. The Attorney General gets involved in that, the Office of Energy Security gets involved in that, and that is a full public process where the evidence for the need for the power line is fully examined in a public way. The second step of that has been mentioned is the routing of the line, and that also has to be approved by the Public Utilities Commission. They have the final authority, and in answer to Representative Mulry's question, there is at least an implication here on some of these same issues. For example, I know that the gentleman who spoke about the pyrotechnics company, when the CapEx group found out that that was the nature of his business and the problems that would be involved in putting the line there, we went in and proposed two alternate routes that bypassed his land. And it's our expectation that those are going to be the routes that are chosen by the Public Utilities Commission. And so while it doesn't directly address the exemptions that are in, under discussion here, at least in that particular respect. The Public Utilities Commission does play a role in examining the route through the environmental process and the convenience and the cost on all of those factors. And I believe in the case of that particular situation, the Public Utilities Commission process is going to take care of that problem. And then, of course, in the rare instances where we do have to go to a condemnation proceeding, that's also an adjudicatory process with a neutral third-party decision maker and the opportunity for all affected parties to come in and be heard. So we do think that Minnesota has a fair, honest, and open process to determine these issues. Now, through our conversations with members of the legislature during the last session over the interim, including conversations with Representative Bly, we certainly are aware that there is a strong desire on the part of the legislature to re-examine particularly these exemptions. And as Mr. Ahern mentioned, we would like to do that. We want to participate in that. But there are important considerations on both sides of the question. Utilities are in a different situation than municipalities who, for example, are taking one private business to turn it over to another private business. So we welcome this hearing, and we welcome further conversations over the interim and moving into the next session, where we can start balancing the needs of utilities to move forward in a cost-effective, efficient process without delays, so that we can deliver the energy that our customers expect, while at the same time respecting some of the issues that have been raised here, and make sure that private property owners are being treated fairly. So we do think it's appropriate to look at these sections of the law. We would like to do that, but we think that it's going to require us to look at each individual section and determine whether the utilities are, in fact, in a unique situation that perhaps requires some protections to remain without the wholesale wiping out of the statute. Just noticed this morning that Representative Bly has made some further suggestions for changes to the bill. Obviously, there's a recognition that not all parties are created equal in this, as other people are now going to be exempted even if we are not. That's good. That's important. But we would hope that in the case of the utilities, we'd be able to look at this, meet with the other parties, meet with the stakeholders, meet with Representative Bly and other interested legislators, and make sure that what we're doing is not increasing costs and delays unnecessarily while still protecting the rights of the property owners. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't have a question. I just have a comment. There's at least a couple of us that remember back that Mr. Sundberg referenced the fact it wasn't handled perfectly by the utilities before, but on the other side, that did have an effect on eventually electing a U.S. senator. So you do have an effect on important politics.
Any questions for Mr. Evans?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Evans, just to clarify again, the hesitation on the repeal, I would assume it's the fear may be some abuse of the system if it was repealed, and you can tell me on that, your opinion on that. And if so, should maybe we be talking about, if there is a repeal, penalties involved, if it's determined that there is abuse, simply to hold up the process or maybe holding the utility company hostage for more land value or something.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kelly, I think that's a, you touch on a good point. For example, the statute that would not permit us to make lowball offers and have some enforcement for that, I think that is something we can talk about and see if there's something we can do in that respect. But on the other hand. You can't allow a property owner, and not every property owner that we deal with is going to be a small residential property or a farm property. Sometimes it's going to be large corporate properties that have at least as deep a pockets as us. And we don't want to be in a situation where the balance is tipped too far. If based on discussions we decide, determines the balance is too far one way or the other, let's be careful not to tip it too far in the other direction. So I think you're right. That's one thing we want to talk about, is whether we don't create a situation where the power lines are going to be made unreasonably expensive and unreasonably delayed through the application of of this law. So let's be careful about that. Another one that I think, you know, is we'd like to talk about further is the need to purchase appraisal. When we build long power lines, we cross a lot of pieces of property. The vast majority of those are non-controversial. Now, I understand what Representative Bitson says. Maybe they're non-controversial because the people give up. But maybe they're non-controversial because they really aren't controversial. And to have the utility companies go out and purchase appraisals that nobody's ever going to look at and nobody's ever going to use doesn't necessarily make sense. And so that's another section we'd like to look at and see if there's some way to strike a balance between the needs of the utilities and the needs of the landowners so that it's an open, honest, and fair process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Evans, if I hear you correctly, you will be going through section by section of that you're currently exempt from and presenting something to Representative Blythe before the next legislative session?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vistens, yeah, as a matter of fact, I was in Representative Bly's office 2 or 3 days ago. We started the conversation. I think we made some progress in understanding where the different sides were coming from, and we hope to continue that, absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Evans, a little late, but better late than never, all right? This bill has been out there for quite some time, and I would have hoped that all public service corporations would have taken the time by now to elicit on section by section what your complaint is, what your problem is. You know, I asked Mr. Sundberg very specifically which ones you routinely violate, and to oppose something simply to oppose it because it's change. I understand change can be hard, all right, but change, opposing something simply because it's change is fundamentally illogical. So I'm glad you're going to finally take the time and go through piece by piece. I have one other comment, Mr. Chair, and that is the comment Mr. Evans made about some of these landowners aren't the little guy. Absolutely they're not, and that's why we see some real strange deviations in routes sometimes, isn't it, Mr. Evans?
Mr. Evans. What I can tell you about the routes is that the utilities are required by the PUC to propose 3 alternate routes. Any member of the public or any other interested party has the full opportunity to present routes to the Public Utilities Commission, and ultimately they make the decision. I think they probably do it based on a whole bunch of factors. It's probably not easy. And just as we make decisions as we try to lay out the routes, I don't think that the process is unfair, and I don't think the process picks on people unfairly. That's not the experience I've ever heard from anybody, but I'm not intimately involved in that. But I do think that the routes need to be decided in an open way with everybody having an opportunity to be heard.
Mr. Chair, my question isn't for the testifier, it's for the author about the bill. Whenever it's appropriate.
Why don't you go ahead with that, Paul? Mr. Joffrey is coming to the witness stand.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bly, on your draft that was dated yesterday, I'm concerned about the language on lines, page 1, lines 12 and 13, relative to an international economic development zone. Can you tell me why that's in your bill?
Representative Bly.
The free law.
The free law. Do you want to clarify this for
us? Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Holder. The language on that's underlined on lines 1.10 through 1.13 are taken from the definition of public service corporation earlier in this chapter, and it just what's there are the non energy entities.
And, well, Mr. Chair, this has to do with a proposal that came through the legislature 4 or 5 years ago about the opportunity to build a distribution center. Most believed that the location would be somewhere in Dakota County, around Rosemont, etc. And I had to, in order to get the cobwebs out, I had to pull out the statute to kind of brush up on this, but under that chapter, it says that this designation of the zone must be done by June 30th, 2008, and I don't think that ever happened, number one. And number two, as I read this, and maybe somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, but right now I'm assuming that this is a non-issue given that that threshold wasn't met, number one. But number two, if that's not the case, right now I believe that the property owners within that designated zone would fall under the eminent domain standards for local units of government and in fact have certain rights. And I'm wondering if the net effect of this language in this proposal would then take those rights away. So I'm a little concerned that there may be inadvertent consequences for language that may be not even necessary.
Well, certainly that would not be my intent to do that. And again, Mr. Eloff, I think, was trying to capture how to explain where we were when we ended the session last time. And in fact, the exemptions that we were asking to be removed were just for utilities. So when we put this language in here, it's trying to reflect, again, where we were at the end of session. And as Representative Diskin pointed out, he wasn't ready to necessarily go down that route. And certainly I intend to talk with interested parties about what needs to be there. But for the interest of discussion, we wanted to make sure that you knew kind of where we'd ended up.
And, Mr. Chair, I think maybe it might be time that to remove that language out of here, but also I'm thinking that there might be a need for a repealer of obsolete language in that section of law, given that no action occurred before June of 2008.
Thank you.
Mr. Johnson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, chairs and members of the two committees. My name is Craig Johnson. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. I'd like to take a couple of minutes to, one, respond to a couple of questions that have already been asked, and then, two, to change the direction of this discussion a little bit to talk about some other impacts of this legislation. First of all, to reply to earlier questions about what the League has for information on this, we only have some anecdotal information that has come in. We actually, as part of our annual survey of cities this year, are trying to get more detailed information. The information we do have has indicated pretty significant increases in costs in some cases, but not all cases. Some cases, the appraisals and everything were coming in, and it turns out the city had been doing it right all along. Other cases, there were some, I think, surprisingly high valuations brought in by the property owners. And when you end up reaching a compromise through a judicial process where they go toward an average, it can end up looking like a very extreme difference, even though it was kind of an averaging process that resulted in that. I'll get to details on that as soon as we get them, but we're working on trying to get some more concrete cases. Frankly, development has been so slow the last 2.5 years that there have not been a tremendous amount of cases where we are able to expand services. And what I'm going to be talking about a little bit here is the municipal utilities that are not being covered here, or that are being removed from the exemption, that are not electric or gas. In the definition of public service corporations, the definition includes municipal utilities and municipalities acting on behalf of a utility. That does not limit it to electrical and gas. It goes far beyond that. It includes wastewater, stormwater, drinking water, sewer, sidewalk, anything else that's organized as a utility in your city. Most of the requirements of the environmental parts of those, wastewater, stormwater, and drinking water for public health, are very heavily regulated, and in fact the extension and the need for the easement are to provide a mandated service to an area, to relieve a pollution problem, to provide safe drinking water to an area where there is not another alternative for that. The initial bill and the 070 draft in front of you today both remove municipal utilities from having the streamlined easement process and mean that we would have to go through the much more time-consuming and potentially much more expensive process involved with the standard property takings as opposed to what is cut out right now as being different because it's for a public purpose and it's an easement. As those of you who are around remember, there were not a lot of exceptions made for what local governments could do as far as dealing with uses of private property in 2006. It was a pretty sweeping analysis of what we do, and municipal utilities in particular were singled out for their use of easements because it so clearly, in most cases, is a public purpose to extend that water, sewer, cable, broadband, whatever the municipal utility is responsible for there, to a broader public audience. And it does not remove the need to do appraisals, does not remove the need to reach evaluation, but it does remove some of the more time-consuming and expensive challenges over legal fees, things of that nature. I do want to say the league did work on this briefly last session. We were very comfortable with the language that moved forward. Again, to be very clear, cities are preempted by law from having any impact on the siting of a high-voltage transmission line. So you can, I guess, you know, talk to our utility friends about what that takes for them to do it, but it doesn't affect us. That's not the business cities are in. And that seemed to be the nexus of the issue last session. We addressed that by having changed in Chapter 117 the appraisal fee amount. It used to be for easements. It was a $500 cap on appraisal fee awards. That was changed to $1,500 for all public service corporations, including these water utilities and things that I'm talking about. And for high voltage transmission lines, it was put at $3,000. There was further language that Representative Bly added on the floor on a pretty strong floor vote in the House that did not end up in the conference committee report, but that language, again, was very specific only to high-voltage transmission lines. And I guess that's what I would like to ask the committee to keep in mind as this is going forward is public service corporation is a very broad category that includes a lot of pretty important services for your communities. If there's a problem with an area, rather than sweeping through statute and saying, let's change it all and then find out later where we may have run into problems, let's look for where the problems are, identify them, and look for solutions to fix them. We'll be very happy to work with the author and the committees on doing that this session. But in many of these cases where we're being required to put in stormwater service to deal with a federally required TMDL that's just been done, we have an annual permit. The city would be fine if we do not meet that need, and to allow a process to get more bogged down and more expensive to meet that requirement is not going to serve a public interest when what we're trying to do is meet a stormwater standard. So I thank you, members. I'd be happy to respond to whatever questions I can.
Questions for Mr. Johnson? Okay, no, thank you. Mr. Schmidt?
Good morning. My name is John Schmick. I'm a commercial real estate appraiser, and I've had a little bit of experience with this law in the past few years. Along the way, I'm going to comment on some of the comments that have been made here, because I find this has been a very educational proceeding for me. I've been doing appraisal work for about 24 years now, most of it litigation-oriented. I represent government and I represent property owners. Whoever wants to call and hire me doesn't make any difference. The answer is the same, regardless of who hires me. A couple of years ago, we had a pipeline come through the southern part of the metropolitan area, the Mincan Pipeline. And as much as you'd like to believe that everybody does a good job of treating property owners fairly, that's not always the case. In that particular situation, there was a number of property owners had to deal with multiple right-of-way agents, lots of broken promises, threats, and ultimately had to get an attorney to go to court to get the judge to order the pipeline company to turn over an appraisal just so the property owner could understand the basis for the offer. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of time spent. That's unreasonable. When they did get some of those appraisals,
they were outdated, and they were restricted use appraisals, which basically state, in the worst cases, here's your value, here's your property, thank you very much. Not at all enough information to form a decision on, to base a decision on, as to whether or not you want to accept that offer. Now, I've heard a lot of talk here about how getting rid of this exemption will increase their cost. Well, let's be very clear about that. These exemptions provide a subsidy for these utility companies, these public service companies. They don't have to recognize the full cost of going through a proper process and giving everybody equal treatment and everybody laying their cards on the table and having the same amount of power. There was a comment here about the amount of power in eminent domain. There has to be a balance between the power of eminent domain and the ability to defend yourself against it. When you take somebody's property, you are being sued to take away something, and you haven't done anything wrong. This is not a criminal case. You own something, somebody wants to take it away, and you have to defend yourself. Why are we creating subsidies that say you don't have to go through this process? We can streamline this, you know, just go in there, make your offer, go off to your project. There's no delays in these projects. That's what the quick take provision is for in the law. You go to the court, you say, here's our public purpose. The court says, fine. 90 days later, title's vested, you go forward with your project. The only thing that gets delayed is the ultimate cash payment to the property owner, which can sometimes happen 2, 3, 4, 5 years after the project is done. Project doesn't get delayed. Now, I want to thank Mr. Thunberg, who very eloquently argued that they don't need these exemptions. If you're doing things right, and you're providing these appraisals, and you're negotiating in good faith, and you're reaching settlements, that's wonderful. That's the perfect argument for saying you don't need exemptions. If you're not doing that, and I'll be the first one to admit that on both sides of these arguments, there's good players and there's bad players. Good players don't need these exemptions because they're doing everything right and they're minimizing their litigation costs. What these exemptions create is an opportunity for the bad players, like the MNCAN project. I also want to address this misconception about this wonderful system we have about the process of coming to these eminent domain situations. You know, they have to have a certificate of need, and that's wonderful, great open process, everybody can come and talk. Not relevant at all to the issue in front of you. The routing permit, once they've cited where they're going to put this, wonderful process, everybody can come and talk, also not relevant to the issue before you. The issue before you is after they've got their certificate of need, after they've got their route, now it's time to come and take somebody's property. Now what is the process? Everything else is behind you. When they talk about a routing process, they're not going to talk about how much they're going to pay an individual property owner. When they're talking about certificate of need, they're not talking about, well, we're going to take this guy's, you know, we're going to take 50 feet across this guy's property. They're talking about getting the right to build it. Now that they've got the right to build it, let's go take somebody's property. I have had cases in the past where they wouldn't even provide a survey of what they were taking. Now, how can you possibly render a decision on whether or not you're going to accept an offer if you don't even know what's being taken? So what happens is you end up having to hire attorneys, you end up having to hire appraisers, and it's expensive. There's no question about it. One of the arguments that we made back in 2006 was these kinds of exemptions and these kinds of a process create a huge economic club that these public service companies can use to beat down property owners. If you're facing $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 in fees to defend yourself, it's a whole lot easier to take a lower offer than fight. One of the things I always tell my clients in eminent domain, you have to stay focused on your family, your career, and your faith, because the eminent domain process will drive you crazy.
And if you don't stay focused on other things and let the process work, you'll go nuts. I've had people on the verge of emotional breakdown because this process is so stressful. So having these exemptions from the normal process simply adds to that stress, simply adds to that problem. Now, we've heard that the law changed in 2006, and there was some comment here earlier that things seem to be working well. And I will tell you from my perspective, it is, because I'm having fewer cases. Things are getting settled. Offers are more fair. The negotiating position of both sides is more even. And once you have an even playing field, and both sides are laying their cards on the table, it is easier to reach a settlement. Now, you're always going to have differences in appraisal theory, the impact of the taking. You're going to have abuses on both sides. That's inevitable. But those are the rarity. Those are the small percentages. Out of 100 eminent domain cases, you might have 3 or 4 property owners that are unreasonable. And in those situations, it's best for the appraiser just to walk away and say, handle it on your own, I'm out of here. But unfortunately, our profession is like every other profession. You can hire what you want. You're going to have offers coming in from public service companies. Sometimes you know what they're based on, sometimes you don't. They have a particular viewpoint. But I think if you level the playing field and both sides can see what's going on, and that means appraisals up front, that means negotiating in good faith, that means no threat to the property owner. We had situations in some of those minicamp situations where there were threats that if they didn't take the offer and go to court, when they got to court, what was going to be offered and testified to was going to be lower than the initial offer. And lo and behold, that happened. Now, what sense does that make? How does that facilitate a process in which everybody can come to a meeting of the mind? It doesn't. Now, I want to be very clear. These kinds of exemptions create a subsidy. They create an imbalance of power in the negotiating process. Your politicians, you know, once somebody's got a subsidy, they never want to give it up. But that hasn't prevented fairness from coming into the system once the 2006 changes came in. People, the utility companies, the public service companies that are doing this right don't need these exemptions. There should be one process for everybody. I don't see a lot of difference between the eminent domain process for widening the street and putting in a pipeline. It's still the process of taking somebody's property. Why should there be exemptions for one and not the other? There's no reason, no valid reason, not to have one set of procedures for everybody. I'm sorry if I get a little passionate about this, and I've probably left my notes behind, but this simply is not an acceptable situation. The only change that you need to make in this law comes down to one word, one simple word, delete it. That's all you have to put behind statute 117-189 is delete it. And you will create a level playing field for everybody. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Crick. Are there questions for this witness? Representative Pierce.
I have a question for staff. When it comes to, maybe this is Mr. Ela, when there's a certificate of need done, like for electric utility, their rate of return regulated, so their rates are actually set by a public body. How about common carriers like pipelines? Are they exempted? Can they just pretty much do a contract rate for whatever the market will bear? Or do they have to go in front of the PUC as well to set rates for transporting gas, water, oil, whatever they have in the line? Do you follow my question, Bob?
I believe I follow your question, Representative Beard. My understanding is that a lot of those rates are set at federal level rather than the state level.
Okay. It's slightly relevant to the discussion. The witness piqued my curiosity because I see common carriers are noted here too, and pipelines are technically common carriers. So. And maybe we can have that the next time this comes up again, maybe we can get that question answered.
Mr. Chairman, the comments there reminded me of the fact that the definition of public service corporation, while it does include some municipal utilities, pipelines, power lines, things like that, these are all profit-oriented entities. They may be heavily regulated, but they're still paying dividends on their stocks. Through ownership structure, there's profit somewhere in those pipeline companies. Cities are different. Cities are funded by taxpayers. There's no profit motive there. If you would require a city who wants to widen a street to follow a certain procedure, why would you give a profit-oriented company exemption? It makes no sense.
Thank you. We have remaining on the agenda three attorneys. I guess it's kind of difficult to expect that they would keep their comments brief, but we did all nonetheless. Try to give it your best shot. Representative Mullen.
I just want to note that it wasn't an attorney that took up most of the time.
Mr. Kraft.
Chair Hilty, it may be that Mr. Kraft is ill. I don't think he was able to make the hearing today. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do we have a stand-in, or are we going to Mr. Sewell?
I think we're going to Mr. Sewell.
All right.
Or
did thank you. Oh, thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairs and Committee. My name is Greg Soule. I live at 2915 345th Street out in Warsaw Township. It's out between Cannon Falls and Northfield. I am an attorney. I'm not representing anybody here today. Unfortunately, I'm not a condemnation attorney. I'm a real estate attorney. But I'm kind of coming to you with two perspectives. One is from my farmer neighbors, which obviously were much better represented by the gentleman from the Farmers Union, but also as an attorney, just pointing out a couple of points. You have my testimony in written form, and some of it is duplicative of what's already been spoken, so noting the chairman's admonition, I will try and be brief and not too repetitive. The first point I want to make, just kind of from out with the people that I live with, all the farmers, is that, and I'm speaking about CapEx, and this is not an anti-CapEx exercise. It's really just to let you know how impactful something like that is to the people out in where I live. One of the things I can show you, and you can see this in greater detail if you want to go to the CapEx website that Excel has put up, it's their picture, is to just get a sense of how massive the scale of this stuff is. I mean, this is one of their sample towers, and you can see that there's that little tiny green dot is a car, and then this thing right here is a regular telephone pole. So it gives you a sense of what the scale of these things are. I mean, they completely dominate a landscape. They completely change the whole texture of the area that they're placed into. The second impact is noted on this drawing over here, where it's one of the routes that was originally proposed. It's not currently an active one, so I don't want to misrepresent it, but it was one of the ones that was originally proposed by Excel. And this shows about a 12-mile stretch, and there are over 20 farms whose farm fields would be subdivided by that line. And when you divide a farm field with something like this, it has a material interference with those operations. So it's a big deal out where I live. It's not welcome. I know it has to be someplace. But I just want you to understand, it really has a big impact on people, probably well beyond however it's going to be recompensed. A lot of the people who are out there, people who live on century farms, they've had these in their families their whole lives, there's people who've lived there their whole lives. And so to suddenly completely transform their world like this is a big deal. I'm not saying don't do it. I'm just saying recognize it's a big deal. As Mr. Peterson did mention, I want to emphasize that generally the folks out there do feel completely powerless when these things come to town. They already know that they can, that the utility can take whatever land they want. And they already know that the utility is going to put it wherever they want. And so by the time you've lost those two battles, you don't have a whole lot more fight in you left to talk about how much you're going to get paid for your land. So most of the people out there say, you just can't fight them. There's nothing I can do about this. It just is what it is. So you are dealing with people who do feel completely powerless. And then when the law makes them powerless, it puts them completely behind the eight ball. Let me just mention a couple points as an attorney. It's been really well spoken that we're trying to level the playing field here. The utilities have all kinds of resources. When this was first proposed for my neighborhood, I'm a real estate attorney, so I know a little bit about some of these things. I said, I know what we need. We're going to need some experts, some engineers, different people who can help us maybe do the analysis of where the various siting is going to be so we can have the experts to talk to the XL experts. I talked to 15 different companies. They were all conflicted out because they all already worked for utilities. So you can't buy the expertise because it's already been sucked up. They have all the experts, they have all the ratepayers, and to fund what they're doing, and then we have to pay for it out of our own pocket. The point was made about the 2006 reforms. From going to some of the hearings last spring, it seemed to me that some of the people who were engaged in that, and I wasn't, and you folks would know better, so I don't mean to be presumptuous, but it seemed like you were, you were going after the overuse of condemnation, sort of the Best Buy deal and Rich deal and stuff like that. But the fact is those procedural safeguards apply equally to any kind of a taking circumstance. It's all about the price. A couple of the arguments that the utilities have raised, and it's always rewarding when what you think they're going to say they actually do say, because then you've already kind of thought about how you respond to it. One of their claims is that they're highly regulated, and the gentleman who just testified made it very clear that the certificate of need and the siting has absolutely nothing to do with the price number. And so you can go through all your hearings for certificate of need and siting, but that doesn't do you diddly when it's time for you as the farmer to sit at your kitchen table and have the guy from the utility come in and say, how much am I going to pay you for the land? I might give you I really like analogies, and I'll be very brief. But it reminds me of a circumstance my wife and I were talking with our daughter. And so if you want to consider my wife and I as PUC and my daughter as XL, she wanted to have us buy a car for her. So we first had to do a certificate of need analysis, and that was very thorough, and it was brought through mom and dad. And then there was the siting analysis, which is, well, which car ought I to get? And that was brought through mom and dad, and it was very carefully done. But then she said, don't worry about how much it's going to cost. I'll take care of that. And that's the situation we have here. We'll do the certificate of need, we'll do the siting, but when we get time to the money, there's no regulation at all. So that's why you need to equal that playing field. Senator Diskins, I remember from a hearing back in the spring when the issue was raised, well, aren't these all going to gum up the works, et cetera, and you said, roughly, you can correct me if I get the quote incorrect, these are the same kind of chicken little, the sky is falling arguments we heard from MnDOT last time, and none of them have come to pass. So I would just repeat that, and if you want to check with MnDOT, I think their representatives kind of know the way to this building and probably know a few of you guys, and so they would have talked to you if there'd been a huge problem, and there doesn't appear to be a huge problem. And then kind of going to my favorite argument, which is, we never hardly ever do condemnation anyway. And this has actually been well discussed here. Representative Diskins went through it. There's really two alternatives. Either the utilities are so reasonable with their prices that these reforms will be passed and no one really had to take advantage of them because they were already getting a great price. Why would I have to engage in a lot of extra expense and debate and dialogue if I'm already getting a fair price. But I think the reality for many people is much the opposite. That is, they are so beaten down. And when the attorney comes, when they go to the attorney and say, well, I didn't have a choice about where it is or when it is or what it is, but can I at least get a fair price? The attorney says, well, yeah, but it'll cost you this and this and this. And by the way, these guys don't have to play by the same rules that the government has to play by. So that's the end of my testimony. I hope I was brief enough, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Thole, are the offices of law, Best and Flanagan in Minneapolis or in St. Paul?
Minneapolis.
Thank you.
Is there any actual questions? Sorry.
That was a question.
Dave, thank you. Let's send it by.
I don't want to preempt Ms. Oberlin. But I do have another person, if there's time, or if you would indulge the time, Mr. Johnson would like to testify as well, if that's possible. So, go ahead.
Good morning, members of both committees. Mr. Chair. My name is Carol Overland. I'm speaking today as an attorney who represents landowners in powerline proceedings, fighting proceedings across the state, across the country. At this point, I'm speaking as an individual. First, I really want to heartily thank Representative Bly for standing in that and being in this, supporting this bill, offering this bill. This is really an important thing. First, I want to state that I have strong support repealing the exemption. It's needed. Utilities are not special. There were other options discussed years ago, and there was a comment a while back about there was a landowner task force, and there was no result from that landowner task force. This was a part of the 2005 bill. And part of that was because landowners weren't represented on that task force. It wasn't people also, or attorneys representing landowners. And so they were not able to come to any kind of resolution. Years before that, Senator Vickerman had introduced SF 462, and that was about a stream of payments option, and that might be something you might want to take a look at, a little history. And you know, you have my comments in writing, so I'm not going to go over those. I'm going to pick a few comments that people have made that I want to comment about. MnDOT, there is a policy of utility accommodation, so if you go to their site and check that out, you can get an idea of what their policies are. Regarding notice, in the CapEx proceeding, there was a pile about this big of landowners who got notice. It was tiny, tiny print, sheets of spreadsheets listing landowners who got notice in July 2008, a year after 80,000 landowners got notice. But there were about 7,000 to 8,000 landowners who got notice about a year late. And those are the kind of people who are being affected now. They got their notice at a time when it was like two or three days before the end of the intervention opportunity. Two landlords from Rochester did try to get in. They were not allowed in. And they could not even participate in the certificate of need process. That also happened with, for example, Julian Rush Martin and Joyce Osborne tried to intervene in the MnCan proceeding. They were not allowed in. They were allowed in to the CapEx proceeding, but the judge tried to throw them out. So this is not an open proceeding in certificate of need. You need to be really clear about that. It's a very difficult thing for people to participate in, very hard, and to be very clear, it has nothing to do with the eminent domain proceeding. That's appellate court. I mean, that's the condemnation court. And I've had the appellate court tell me in when I represented World Organization for Landowner Freedom, we took, one of the issues we raised was that people were not notified about the option to buy the farm. And we were told very specifically by the appellate court, no, you have to take that to condemnation court. We don't deal with that here. It was not an issue to be dealt with at the agency level. It's something that has to go to the condemnation court. So let's keep that separation here. This has nothing to do with certificate of need proceedings. It has nothing to do with environmental quality board proceedings or currently commerce proceedings for siting. This is completely different. Someone had raised the issue of potential abuse of process. We have Rule 11 to protect us from abusive process. So we don't need to have any special legislative mandates there. If it's a process, it's not going to happen. Let's see. And someone else has said Mr. Johnson has testified that cities are not in the business of eminent domain and power lines. And, you know, yes, that is possible because the fact is, do have 216E.05, and that's local review. So a utility can, at its option, under certain circumstances, pick local review, and so the cities may look at that. But anyway, in short, I urge you to continue to work towards removing public service corporations from exemptions. They don't need it. Keep it a level playing field. That's it. Any questions, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Overland, this is related, but for the edification of members, we had a meeting about CapEx down in Mazeppa about a week ago now, and had about 70 people there, and we talked about this issue and others. Ms. Overland, you've got a website, legalelectric.org.
That's correct.
And there's a blog on the front of it.
It is a blog.
Yeah, it is a blog itself. I was very interested to see someone pass this along to me shortly after we hold a meeting in order to benefit the public so they understand the process and what's happening and how they can provide input into that process. We come out with a blog with three different legislators, two of them on this committee, two that have very little to do with CapEx in the district, and they're trying to learn more about the CapEx process, only to learn you bring out a bunch of disparaging remarks, these legislators. This is shameful. I would also offer you this. After the meeting was done, mm-hmm. I had a sign-up sheet at the table so that I could continue to communicate with my constituents about this issue.
Yes.
And I got done with the meeting, and the sign-up sheet was gone. Well, lo and behold, two people came to me and said, do you recognize this flyer?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You said it.
Two people came to me and said, how did this get to me? I signed your sign-up sheet, and suddenly I'm getting these unsolicited things in the mail. Can you explain yourself?
Certainly. I took a picture of it. I did not take it. I am an officer of the court. I'm the officer who signed an affidavit. I did not take it. In fact, Kirk Stubleaker may have. She was standing at the table and was in charge of collecting those names. I took a picture of it.
I am offended by your behavior, and I would hope that we would see an ability for you to come forward in this process to work with people and actually talk with them instead of developing these types of positions. This is offensive.
Mr. Chair, may I address that?
Very briefly, but I think we're kind of stretching the bounds here.
I would agree. I think we're stretching the bounds here. Because what I was raising in that was that Representative Drzelski was saying that he didn't know about this committee meeting and wasn't pushing this committee meeting and explaining to people, all those concerned landowners there, that this was something that they needed to be concerned about and that they could represent themselves by being here today. And it was on what date was that? It was like 6 days after I received notice of this meeting, and this one, he didn't have notice of the meeting. And so that's what I was commenting on, and that's what he feels is disparaging. Well, this is an important meeting, and my goal is to get people notice about it and to let landowners know what their options are, like buy the farm, which was not mentioned at that meeting. And there's a number of issues. They're all on the blog. But there were a number of issues that landowners need to know, and that's what I was raising. Thank you.
Thank you. This is Mr. Johnson.
Chair and committee members, thank you for your time. My name is Robert Johnson. I'm a 40-year business owner in the Twin Cities. I'm also a property owner in Dakota County and someone who's been involved in part of this process through becoming involved in the whole CapEx project for some amount of time. I'd just like to comment briefly because I know we're coming up against the lunch hour and I can see some of us are already looking at the clock wondering where we're going to have lunch. But I'd like to comment just briefly on 2 points. The first point is, and if I have the gentleman's name incorrect, I apologize for that. Was it Sundberg? The comments made by Mr. Sundberg I'm in the investment business. We finance commercial real estate around the country, and I really appreciated and enjoyed his comments, because if he spoke that way in our industry, then the recent crash in the stock market and the ups and downs in the economy, you would believe, didn't exist. I don't agree that the process is at all as fair and as open as was described there. I took it upon myself to make some phone calls over the last year to citizens in Minnesota, and I found five or six of them who have had to go through this process over the years. One woman called me in tears at home when she heard that I was looking for people who had been involved in this process, and none of them felt like they were treated fairly. So yes, we have a process that exists out there, but you know what, it really doesn't function very well at all. The only other point I'd like to touch on is something that I heard while I was sitting in the audience several times. It had to do with the cost involved in this eminent domain process. And I have to tell you, I was sitting up here almost feeling sorry for the utilities, because it sounded as if treating the people, the landowners, fairly was going to somehow break the bank. I had my assistant yesterday pull what she told me was the most recent annual report for Xcel. Do any of you in this room know how much Xcel made net last year? Do you want to guess? She told me it was $643 million. At that kind of a rate, that's $3 million per working day for every 8 hours, and I would submit to you that they've got more money than God. They can go out and compensate the landowners fairly and treat them fairly. They're not some poor, thread-worn public service company. They're a for-profit corporation making decisions to increase their bottom line. God bless them. But they shouldn't really do it on the backs of the property owners. So the purpose of my being here today is to add my voice to others who have come before you, to urge you to level the playing field a little bit, to bring some balance to this whole process. If anyone in this room believes that there's any balance at all today in the eminent domain laws of Minnesota, I'm going to stand up and tell you there are not. It's all in favor of the utilities. Last quick thought on something else I heard. You know, the average Minnesota landowner does not have access to the system. He or she can't afford it. Xcel made $643 million last year, the average landowner in Minnesota makes between $50,000 and $80,000 a year. They can't find the money to pay for the defense that they need to put up. It's just not there. The utilities have got all the muscle, they've got all the money, they've got all the lobbyists, they've got all the attorneys. My wife and I, in one action last year related to this, called five law firms in the Twin Cities to find legal representation. And my wife is an attorney, so she knew some people. I know some people. Mike Ahern, I think, is up here. I think you're with Dorsey. We use Dorsey a lot. But all five law firms turned down representation for us because they're all conflicted out. Now, if you're some landowner out in Albert Lea or Redwood Falls or wherever, how are you going to access the system? You can't do it. There's no effective way to do it. Well, that's the realities of life. But if you take that kind of a on-balance situation and then you pile on exemptions on the side of the utilities besides, you have an unconscionable condition that really stands to be corrected. So coming up to lunch, I'd urge you to... I like what the other gentleman said. Use that one word. It's the same thing you'll find on the key on your computer. I think it's called delete. Just get rid of the exemptions. If they're doing it right, they don't need the exemptions. If they're doing it wrong, then we have other recourse. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Johnson?
At the risk of being stolen, Mr. Chairman, I will ask one simple question, Mr. Johnson. You criticize the process we have, even though you have heard that there are very few people that don't go in and do it.
They can't afford to. I mean,
I don't know about that, but if you have, with all your research, a different and better way of doing it, would you please let us know?
I'll produce a paper for you. How's that?
I would love it. Thank you.
You'll have it. Thank you.
Anything further? If you can be very, very brief.
I can.
Kind of testing everybody's ability.
Thank you. My name is Joyce Osborne, and I live in Burnsville, but I own property in Scott County that the crude oil pipeline, Mincan Pipeline, took 5 acres right alongside the most advantageous road to get into my property, which is developable. I've gone through a mess. I have never felt so degraded. I have never felt so abused as I was with the Mincan Pipeline representative. There's two big issues. The first one is that before they ever got their certificate of need, they had representatives out talking to people from Clearbrook, Minnesota, all the way down to Rosemont, trying to get them to sign easements for which they had no certificate of need yet. And during the routing permit, it was even worse. We were threatened. We were intimidated. I wanted them to go underneath County Road 91, which is a major crossroad. I own land on both sides. Instead of coming across on the north side, they decided to go into my other property on the north side and then come diagonally under a township road. But they told me that to go diagonally under County Road 91, which is a tarred road, they didn't have enough interest in my land, nor was it environmentally sound. Well, they went straight across 91 underneath, and then they went diagonally across the township road. I didn't see the difference. They didn't plant what they were supposed to plant after they were all done, and now I have to go through that process all over. And the pipeline should have to do things properly. They were, I mean, CRP, Conservation Reserve, and they were supposed to have planted what would make me not forego my contract with the CRP, Conservation Reserve. These are all issues. The appraisal was one thing. The appraisal came in so doggone low it was terrible. I had my own appraiser, it cost me $7,500. And for them taking 5 acres of my land is just ludicrous. And that's just the permanent easement. They took 5 acres of temporary as well. And all of that has to be seeded. This whole scenario is a mess. There's got to be better ways to deal with public service corporations. Granted, I'm not sure what they are either, but what I've heard here today is deleted. They should be made to set some kind of a standard that they follow. They should follow the rules. We went in front of the PUC. We were there all day. Landowners, there must have been 150 to 200 landowners. 5 minutes before the deadline, they asked, the PUC decided to make a decision. After they'd heard all of us, they did nothing. They voted for the whole thing to go through. We sat there like we'd been hit in the head with a 2x4. Nobody listened. But anyway, things are going to be done one way or the other. It's just sad that landowners have to bear the brunt of a lot of this mess that could be taken care of right here for landowner benefits. They give benefits to all sorts of people. They give benefits to high voltage transmission lines. They give benefits to all sorts of things. But landowners are stuck down at the bottom, and nobody's listening. Or at least that's what it seems like. Hopefully, something will come out of this. And we would appreciate it tremendously if it did. Thank you.
Thank you. I think it's apparent that this is an issue that we will be dealing with once the legislature is in session. Look forward to continuing the discussion, and this meeting is adjourned.